Okay. Okay, tonight's a little different, folks. It's a little different than usual.
Manish Tana.
No, I'll tell you why it's different. It's
We're doing Passover.
because okay, get it out of your system, folks. Okay, great. Okay.
Don't have a red heifer.
First, I was going to call you Judy, by the way, so be careful, Randy, okay? I saw what the screen
Okay.
Okay, but for tonight, obviously we're going to still focus on the Parsha, which is Parshat Kitisa or Kisisa, if you're from my neck of the woods. It's a long Parsha. It's a difficult Parsha. It has in it some monumental topics, including the conversation about the Jews accepting the Torah, of the famous expression of "We will naaseh v'nishma," we will do and we will listen. It also has within it the sin of the golden calf, which is another whole major topic. But what it is actually the setup of what is going to follow for what we had Truma Tetzaveh the previous 2 weeks, and what we're going to have next time is Vayakhel Pekudei, all dealing with the construction of the tabernacle, the construction of the Mishkan, which is the precursor to the temple in Jerusalem. So the topic is one that repeats itself in a few places. But for tonight, instead of talking about an incident, I want to focus on a biblical character that plays the pivotal role in the story. And that is this fellow by the name of Bezalel. Bezalel is the architect that is chosen to be what do you call it? The architect that's going to oversee the entire project of the construction of the tabernacle. So to really appreciate why him and what is it that's so difficult, nothing against architects, it's a difficult job, but it's okay, this is not just an architectural marvel. There must be something more. This is God's house. So it's got to have something a little bit more. So the way to, I think, to really approach this, that way that we can approach this properly, hold on 1 second, there we go, okay, is the way we can approach this is to understand what the function of the tabernacle was in the first place. We know that if you want to pick the, it's such a central component of thought, indeed, even the way we view history. Jewish history is divided into two sections: during the time of temple and post-temple. That's it. There are no other real divisions other than during the temple time period, during the time of King Solomon, or for the second temple afterwards. There's that period, and then there's everything else. That's how it's divided. It plays a central role. So let's try to understand what the function of the temple slash the tabernacle was all about. We've spoken on other occasions, but allow me to repeat a little bit so that you can understand it. One of the major focuses, foci, I don't know, whatever the word is, of being a part of the Jewish people, and the mission statement is that we're supposed to be bridging the spiritual and physical worlds. We've spoken about this in many different capacities, but the goal is that we are not on one extreme like animals that are living in a purely physical realm, nor are we on the other extreme like angels that are living in a purely spiritual realm. We are the hybrid. We are that combination because our job is to bridge the spiritual and physical worlds. I've mentioned in the past the famous story of Joseph and his brothers. The story we're told towards the end, right, is that when Benjamin finally does come down, nobody knows that it's Joseph yet. He hasn't revealed his identity, but they meet each other and they hug and they cry. But the terminology that the Torah uses is doesn't say that they cried on each other's shoulders. It says that they cried on their necks. Yes, many of you are shaking, which means, okay, it got through. Wonderful. Great. Okay. So then we can just skip to the next page. But the concept that we want to make reference to is why you don't normally cry on someone's neck. You cry on their shoulder. So the concept of your neck is the connector. It's the bridge between your head and the rest of your body. Well, if you had to pick, what would represent the physical side of human beings and what would represent the more spiritual? I think most people would say that from the head is what represents your thoughts, your ideas. That's your spiritual, what you can contemplate in the intangibles. Yes, connected to your heart as well. But your torso down, we pretty much have in common with every other creature. We're physical. There's not a lot of spirituality from the neck down. But what connects the head and the rest of the body, the spiritual and the physical, is the neck. The neck is that bridge. Why is that significant? Let's take it one step further. What is the most prominent feature in your neck? It has two pipes. One is to ingest food, and the other is to let out speech. It's fascinating. Right? Breathing apparatus and your esophagus, your food pipe, windpipe and food pipe. Well, because if you think about it, it really is both of those aspects. Speech, the ability to communicate and share wisdom, which is such an unbelievable concept. Every time I talk about it, I'm like, that really is so cool. I can take a thought. You know, 10 minutes ago, there was just me. I had what I wanted to share with you. And now all of a sudden, I can have the opportunity with 11, or some of you are doubled up. So it's like 13, 14 of you that I can share what was nothing more than a thought. And I can transfer that. And somehow you, hopefully, understand what I'm saying. And you integrate it into your own thought process. How did that happen? It's a thought. It's an intangible thing. The medium by which it's done is through speech, being able to verbalize and articulate a concept. The brain is unbelievable that it can do that, but the only medium by which it can happen is through speech. So speech is the manifestation of that joining of the spiritual and bringing it out into the physical. Hence, voice, speech is located in your neck. That's why it's there. Because that's the concept, okay? Now, once you understand that that's the role of what we're supposed to do, then I understand that when God says he wants to dwell in our midst, which is a concept of, we'll call it spirituality, godliness, coming down into our physical world, and we're defining a place for it, well, then that has to be the representation of the ultimate connection between the physical and spiritual world. Hence, the perfect symbol that would capture it would be the neck. This is what our sages tell us, that when Joseph and Benjamin cried on each other's necks, says the Rashi from an early source, what were they crying about? Not just because they hadn't seen each other in so long, but they were crying about a future event, that ultimately the tabernacle and the temple were going to be destroyed. Now, the tabernacle, the temple, it's easier. The tabernacle was located in Jerusalem, but specifically in Benjamin's portion of Jerusalem. The Temple Mount is, for the most part, in Benjamin's territory when they divided and conquered the land. So Joseph is crying on Benjamin's neck. In fact, if you really want to be careful and you look up the verse, it says necks in the plural. And Benjamin cried on Joseph's neck in the singular. It's interesting. You can look it up. Oh, you want to know where? Fine. Be that way. It is in Genesis, Bereshit, chapter 43. Um, Why am I not finding it? Where is it? I'm blanking. Hold on. Sorry. Maybe it's chapter 44. Hold on. Sorry. All right. I'll find it for you before I leave tonight. Okay. It's here. But the terminology that's used for Benjamin is necks, and for Joseph, it's only singular neck, because the tabernacle, when it finally settled in Israel, it was located in Joseph's portion, in Shiloh. That's where it spent most of its time. So when the sages pointed out that they were crying over the loss of the temple and the tabernacle, they're like, what are you talking about? They're just crying because they haven't seen each other. No, they get it from the fact that it says that they cried on their necks, and the necks is that point of connection between spirituality and physicality. So understanding that the temple, and again, I'll use the word tabernacle because that's our parsha, what it's talking about, that's why it plays such a central role in terms of our thought, our deeds, periods of history, because it's the defining edifice that is the structure that's combining the physical and the spiritual. It's not, you found it, Monroe's found it in 30 seconds or less. I know. Go ahead.
Muted. 45:14.
Okay, 45:14. I knew he'd find it. All right. 45:14. Perfect. Thank you. That's exactly what it says. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's necks. They translated in English as neck, but that's not correct. It's necks in the Hebrew. And wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Monroe. Okay. Now, it'll come to you as no surprise, therefore. When you read in our section of the Torah, where it's talking about the construction, how many total materials are listed in the construction? What's the grand total, not how many ounces of gold, but gold is one material. How many materials are listed?
A lot.
Is that 250? What's a lot?
No, I don't remember, but I know there was a lot.
We talked about 100 yesterday, but was that just the dimensions?
100 was the dimensions of a certain building there.
How about 70?
Wasn't it fully baked?
What?
We'll get there.
Oh, my. Hold on.
Monroe knows. Go ahead, Monroe.
Okay, nobody's got anything yet.
613.
Oh. Just for a number. If this were the Price is Right, you'd all be over and you'd all be thrown out. No.
Come on. What was the question again?
Hi. My name is Rabbi T. I love to teach these classes, and I've been around for a couple of years. My question was, how many is the total list of materials that are listed in what was contributed for the construction? How many items are listed, materials? The lowest number we've had so far, I think, was 70, and it's way over.
Eight.
Seven.
Seven is not correct. Eight is not correct.
Eight.
Still not.
12. Good. 12.
Eight, 18.
The correct answer is, forget it, is 15. 15.
That was close.
No, you were not. You said 250. Okay.
Let's. No, I didn't. I said.
Yeah. You said a lot.
I broke it down to 18.
All right. So why 15?
So why 15? Okay. So listen carefully. The verse that tells us about God creating the universe, it says the following: Ki biyah Hashem tsur olamim. Ki, because, or when, biyud hey, that's yah, yud hey is God's name, tsur olamim, he fashioned the worlds. But the name yud hey is 10, hey is 5. With a yud and a hey, God created our worlds. David, shaking your head. First it's a no, and then it's a yes.
Yes to you, no to me.
Yud and hey. Those are the two letters. And if you remember when we did the Olivet class, we talked about the fact that this world is associated with the letter hey, because it has the dalid, the four that is representative of the physicality, and the little extra yud that makes it into a hey. Hey is our world, this world, and yud is representative of the world to come. If you don't remember, don't worry. It's not on the final. Okay. Ki biyah Hashem, because with the yud and the hey, God created the universe. That means the number 15, which is the yud and the hey, is representative of God creating the universe. Why am I making a big deal about this? Is because you have to understand the concept of the tabernacle, and I'll just get straight to the punchline. The tabernacle was the world's creation in microcosm. It's the small mini version of God creating the universe. And I'm going to show you that the parallels between what the verses tell us about God creating the universe, Adam being in the Garden of Eden, which is the ultimate picture, the utopia that God created for man to live in until he sinned, are going to be ridiculously paralleled. Ridiculous. Let's understand. The Talmud tells us that there were nonstop miracles that took place in the temple. The Mishnah identifies 10 miracles that happened all the time. All the time. Why would miracles happen in the temple? We have to understand that. What was the original state of man vis-a-vis his relationship with God before they sinned? What was life like in the Garden of Eden, specifically in relation to man's involvement and relationship and communication with God? Just curious, what do you envision it was like?
Harmony.
It was harmony. That's a very good word to use. Excellent word. Things were very balanced. Things were in harmony. There was an open line of communication because man was balanced. And obviously, if man is balanced, his connection to God would continue that way, right? That makes a lot of sense. So the situation before the man sinned is like the ultimate picture of where the harmony between God and mankind is beautifully balanced. The harmony is there. But then man sins. Adam and Eve sin. Well, what happens? What happens now? So no more harmony. Things are now imbalanced. Well, okay, in practical terms now, what happens?
They get kicked out.
They get kicked out. Before they get kicked out, there's even more. What happens before that even? Before the banishment. What does God say that if you disobey, now that you have disobeyed, it's going to disrupt the natural order of things? You're going to have to, by the sweat of your brow, you're going to work the fields now. Oh, that wasn't what it like beforehand. Right? We always picture the Garden of Eden, where everything, all my needs are taken care of. That's true. But once man is given a job to obey, eat from all the trees of the garden, but don't eat from that one tree. He's given a mission to follow obedience, right? The privilege. But then if he disobeys, it disrupts the natural order. And if you defy God, you're going to get banished. That's the story of the Garden of Eden. So perhaps we can understand that the entire narrative of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden is almost like the defining the environment in which man can enter into some kind of communication with divine, because that's the way it was created prior to them sinning. It's the prototype. That's the word I'm looking for. The prototype of the conditions and the environment that are intrinsically needed to encounter God. It could even be the paradigm for even subsequent settings, subsequent opportunities to commune with God. The Garden of Eden is the prototype. Well, we know that if you look carefully, you find certain similarities. For example, Sid, you correctly pointed out that the punishment after defying God's order of not eating from the tree, they were banished. Well, how come they didn't go back in?
There was an angel placed there with a sword to keep them out.
Fabulous. Do you remember what the name of that sentry was known in the Torah as? I don't want to know his name. I don't know his name. But the Torah defines, it uses a word that I'll give you a hint. There's only one other context in where that word is ever used, and it had to do with the tabernacle.
What?
This one I got. It's chapter 3, verse 24. So Hashem God banished him from the Garden of Eden to work the soil from which he was taken. And having driven out the man, he stationed at the east of the Garden of Eden the cherubim and the flame of the ever-turning sword to guard the way to the tree of life. The cherubim? What? I thought that's only the thing, you know, like on the ark cover and those angelic figures. Yeah. These are the only two places where cherubim, the cherubims are mentioned. There's a connection. Something about the Garden of Eden environment is going to be found again in the tabernacle environment. Let's keep going. There's many, many examples like this. The iconography that were pictured in various places throughout the temple. For example, you have the idea of can you now go into the Garden of Eden? No, right? You can't access it. But there were two trees that were identified in that garden, were there not? There were lots and lots of trees, but two by name. One we know was the garden, was the tree of life. Well, you see, Robin, you cut right to it. Very good. That's not the one most people say. Most
knowledge. Knowledge.
The tree of knowledge. Yeah. Right, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But Robin, you're right. There's another one that's identified. It's known as the tree of life. Where is that? So I've done extensive research. It's actually on North Market Street in Frederick.
I was just going to say that. I know exactly where it's at. It's 1011.
Sid and Michelle actually designed it. No.
Only Sid.
No, the tree of life. Where is that nowadays? Okay, so you say it's still in the Garden of Eden. But the truth of the matter is that we can't access it physically going back to the Garden of Eden. But don't we have something that takes its place?
Torah.
The Torah. Very good, Monroe. That's right. When we put the Torah back every Shabbat, we sing a song. Eitz Chaim Hi. It's the tree of life to those who cling to it, we say. That's not just a metaphor. This is taking its place. And folks, where was the Torah housed throughout all the years that we had it?
In the Ark.
In the Ark, which was stored in the Holy of Holies of the Tabernacle or the Temple. Exactly. And what's guarding that Torah?
The cherubim.
Oh my goodness. The parallels are ridiculous. You're going to find this throughout. Because what the tabernacle is the microcosm of what God created. On the macro scale, this was the micro scale. The cherubim on top as the sentries, the guards of the most important element. It's not surprising, therefore, just if you know a little bit of the layout of the tabernacle, the entrance to the Holy and Holy of Holies is from the east, because that's where, as the Torah describes, where the Garden of Eden was, because they were banished and went the other way. It was on the east. Same concept. What was the consequence of disobedience? Death, right? They died, right? They now became mortal, right? They became mortal, right? Remember that, right? We all suffer because of it, yes, okay? What's the number one rule about entering into the temple building?
Only the high priest and only on Yom Kippur.
That's the Holy of Holies. I'm talking about the entire temple building. You're right, Michelle.
Purification.
Yeah, you had to be purified. You couldn't be impure. Well, Randy, how does one get impure?
Going to the cemetery.
Coming in contact.
With the dead person.
Folks, do me a favor. Keep yourself on mute unless you have what to say. There's a lot of background noise tonight. Thanks. So coming in contact with the dead is what defiles the person. So if the tabernacle is supposed to be the Garden of Eden in miniature form, that means there can be no, it has to be disassociated with any element of death, because that only comes about after they sin and are getting punished. So the classic Garden of Eden scenario, the environment, is completely removed from anything dealing with death. That's why the rule is that in the temple building, you had to be pure. You couldn't have any connection to being defiled through death. That's why there's no place for that in the temple. The conditions for all of this have to be right. So listen to this. What does this got to do with Bezalel? The Talmud tells us a fascinating piece of information. For what seems to be an unexplained reason, if you read the text of the Torah, when it talks about the greatness of Bezalel, the verse reads as follows. It's in chapter 31 in the book of Exodus, chapter 31, verse 3. Hashem spoke to Moses saying, See, karati b'shem, I have called by name Bezalel, ben Uri, his father's name was Uri, ben Chur, his father was Chur from the tribe of Judah. And I have filled him with the godly spirit, listen to what it says, with b'chachma b'tvuna, uvidat, with wisdom, insight, and knowledge. Now, I've said this many times, the Torah, the author of the Torah was not Charles Dickens. He was not getting paid by the word. So what's with the repetitious of wisdom and insight and knowledge? Those are all words we just throw around as synonyms. Like, why specifically these three? Well, I'd like to share with you another verse, except this verse is found in Mishle, in Proverbs, where it talks about Hashem founded the earth with wisdom. He established the heavens with understanding, and through his knowledge, the depths were cleaved and the heavens dripped dew. The exact same three descriptions of whatever it means that God used to create our world are the exact same three descriptions of what God gave Bezalel the understanding and ability to be the architect for the temple, for the tabernacle. The immediate question is, okay, it's a nice connection with the wording, but who cares? Just say you filled him with wisdom. He knew how to do it. The answer, my friends, is because this isn't just a building. This is going to be the one place on earth that's going to draw that perfect environment of how God created the world, that Garden of Eden kind of existence. And Bezalel needs to be able to tap into that same wisdom, understanding, and knowledge so that he can recreate it in microcosm form. He is blessed with the exact terminology that God used to create the world is what Bezalel was blessed to have the knowledge of to recreate the world in miniature form known as the tabernacle. But let's explore it even. You with me? Okay. But let's explore one step further. I very often would love, I love going, my wife tells me, not so much in the last year or so, but my wife tells me that I have a terrible disease. She reminds me, I have a terrible disease. There are two stores that I cannot physically go into and not buy something. I admit it, there are two stores that I have difficulty going in and not purchasing at least something. One of them is a Jewish bookstore. I have to get something. And the other is Home Depot. I have to get something. What can I say? It's close enough to Yom Kippur. I can start revealing my sins now. Okay. If these are my two biggest vices, I can go to heaven this way. Okay, I'm good. So a few years back, not about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, I was in Shopsies, which is a Judaic bookstore here in Baltimore. And of course, I'm looking around and I came in for one item and I walked out with many. And I picked up a book. It caught my eye. It's called Divine Design. The entire book, look how fat it is. It's in English. The entire book is an analysis of Bezalel's name and all the hidden messages of what we're talking about tonight, of what he was infused with, of this incredible godliness, of how it's alluded to in his name and this his father's name. I will be brutally honest. I don't think I've made it past chapter 4. I'm lost. I mean, I can read every English word I'm able to translate, but when it gets put together as sentences, paragraphs, and chapters, I lose something there, okay? But I want to share with you at least something of what I think I understand. It's brilliant. The verse I read to you from this week's parsha, when God says, I want to introduce you to who the architect of this building will be, the Torah says, Re'eh, God says, see, karati b'shem. I call out by name, Bezalel. That seems pretty wasted words. Just say, behold, Bezalel ben Uri. Just give me his name. Why do you have to say, I call out by name? That's like the teacher the first day of class has to tell everybody. And when I call your name, please acknowledge. Thank you very much. I know how the system works. I mean, if you call my name, I say hi. Why do I have to introduce it by saying I call by name? Right? We're all laughing because we all like, yeah, that's pretty dumb. Right? So why would the Torah say, God would say, Karasi b'shem? He wants to suggest, the author of this book wants to suggest that the Torah is telling us that if you want to really appreciate who Bezalel is, look at his name. His name itself are the keys to understanding his greatness. Oh, now I get it. The Torah, God is saying, I'm going to introduce you and make sure you see b'shem, in his name, all of what I want to teach you. So what's in his name? So again, it's a long conversation, but what you find is as follows. The Torah, again, strangely, gives us three generations. Him, Bezalel. Not only him, but who his father was. His name was Uri. And who his father was, Chor, from the tribe of Judah. Okay, not everybody in the Torah is given name, father's name, and grandfather's name. But yet here it is. The premise of this book is that if you read all four of those descriptions, his name, his father's name, his grandfather's name, and the fact that he's from the tribe of Judah, you'll have the answer to everything. I don't have enough time or the wisdom to really appreciate all of that, but I'll share with you the little that I do understand. What does the word or the name Bezalel mean? It's a nice name. It's a beautiful name. But what does it actually mean? So the Talmud tells us that it's a contraction of two words. Bezalel, which literally means in the shadow of. The last two letters are Aleph, Lamed, El, which is God, like Elohim. Bezalel is the contraction of Bezalel, El, in the shadow of God. Oh, okay. I can live with that. That's a nice concept of whereas very much in line with the theme we're talking about, of where Bezalel was infused with godly spirit. He was in the shadow of godliness. But wait, it gets better. Uri, his father's name, is from the word Or. Or means light, right? Like we have on the first day of creation, God said, let there be light, right? Vayehi Or, and there was light. So something about my light, Uri, my light. And Hur, his grandfather's name. What is Hur? He wants to suggest that it's related to the word Chayrut, which means freedom. When the Jews left Egypt, they attained a certain level of freedom. It's called Chayrut. So he wants to suggest that, like we say, that when we got the Torah, we were Ben Chorin. We became free people. That's the word that's used. So Hur is associated with freedom. Let me give you one more piece and we'll put it all together. Okay? If you're not on overload yet, you will be. Okay. At what point did we become free people in the story of the Exodus? Please identify specifically at what point were we considered free people. And I'll help you. Don't say when we physically left Egypt, because that is incorrect. Don't even say, I'm helping you here, don't even say that it's after the Egyptians were drowned in the sea and we were no longer under, don't say that. That is not correct.
When we got the Torah.
Oh, when we got the Torah. You sure?
When we got to the land of Israel.
Oh, we got to the land of Israel. That's a long time later. That's 40 years, ma'am.
Okay.
Whoa.
I'm stretching.
I think when we got closer, the Torah, because we chose. When you said
50, by the
way. 15.
15. So what did you say, Michelle?
I said I think that when we got the Torah, because we were able to choose to take it and made a decision.
I agree 100%. 100%. However, there's always one little however. Nachmanides, the Ramban, wants to suggest that there are three distinct stages of redemption from Egypt. One was the initial exodus, the actual physical liberation of leaving and not having the Egyptians trying to enslave us again. That's stage number one. Stage number two is the subsequent revelation, the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. However, the Ramban, Nachmanides, argues and says the ultimate level and stage of redemption was not until God brought his presence back down to us with the building of the tabernacle. That was now the final stage of where we were free. You see, I would think he argues on you, Michelle, in the point of, yes, we were able to express our freedom by choosing to accept the Torah, but how do you know that it was a thumbs up? How do you know that God gave his approval of that? Oh, he gave us the Torah. But when did he give us the command to build the tabernacle in relation to the giving of the Torah?
After the golden calf.
No, Rashi says, well, you could be there. That's fine. I'll give you that one. Rashi seems to say it was the day after. That's fine. But Nachmanides holds it's the next day. It was the very next day. Because if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Giving the Torah was like, if I can use the analogy, like when the bride and the groom are under the chuppah and he gives her the ring and he says, you're betrothed to me. Fine. So there is a technical, you know, relationship that they now have. But they haven't started living as husband and wife yet until they go home. That's when it was. The building of the tabernacle and God saying, I will allow my presence to dwell amongst you, that now we have a full-fledged, fully redeemed relationship. The author wants to suggest that that's why the Torah goes out of the way to tell us about Bezalel's genealogy, because it goes in stages. Let's start with the grandfather, right? Because that's the one that's closest. Hur, that we became physically free. We left Egypt. We were liberated. But then came The next generation was the man by the name of Uri. Uri is from light, which we've spoken many times as representative of the Torah. That gives us the clarity of what's right and wrong, the clarity of how to navigate through life. So stage one was Chur, physical freedom. Then came my light, which was the giving of the Torah. And then finally himself, his name is Bezalel, in the shadow of God, meaning he sits in the shadow of God. That's the construction of the tabernacle. This is how he wants to suggest the entire book of what I've read is looking at these, the name of Bezalel and how it permeates to the most fundamental idea that God's presence dwelling in our world through the tabernacle and the temple and what nowadays is through our synagogues and our homes and all of that is the function of recreating what God did back in the Garden of Eden. If your friend, spouse, mother, grandmother, whatever, says that they love coming to your house, it's like it's utopia. It's such a Garden of Eden. You say, thank you. That's exactly right. Because if you are living these principles, you've invited godliness into your home. You've got a little mini temple in your backyard. That's what it is. But that's what the greatness of Bezalel is. He was the architect, not just of a physical building. He was able to tap into the godly wisdom of how to take those concepts that God created the universe with and invest it into a building. The Talmud actually says the greatness of Bezalel is that he knew how to use the alphabet. That's what it says. Now, for those of you taking the alphabet course, you understand perfectly, because the alphabet are the protoplasm. That's what God used to create the universe. God said, let there be light. It means there's a language. That's what Bezalel could do. He knew how to arrange the letters. Now, obviously, we're not talking about he had a blackboard, even a whiteboard or a smartboard. He knew how to tap into the energies of all of that and bring it down to this world. That's what makes the temple, the tabernacle, so unique. And that's what we mourn that we don't have, because we don't have that physical structure that is acting as the bridge of bringing down that godliness in a way that it's hard for even us to fathom. Let me end with this. The Torah is telling us, with this architect of Bezalel, and his assistant, Aholiab, and whatever else was involved. But Saul is the main architect. We have to understand that his role, his function, was not just to create a physical building that's going to look nice and will allow, so to say, godliness to enter into our world. It had to be dialed in exactly the way God did it the first time. It had to be. Because otherwise, the formula is not going to work. You're going to try to create it using a different formula. I don't know, just for argument's sake. It's a terrible analogy, right? But if, let's say, godliness was meant to be brought down with a yud and a hey and a vav and a hey, right? God's name. And Bezalel doesn't really understand what that is. And he says, well, I think what would be better is if we spelled it a tzadi and then a vet and then a yud. That's really what's going to do it. For those who don't know what Sadi Vet Yud, it spells my name Tzvi, just to put it in perspective. Okay. If Bezalel thinks that's the way to bring godliness down here, he's making a tragic error. He's going to end up with me, not God. That's what it is. The shadow that Bezalel's name implies, that he's in the shadow of God, is exactly what it's all about. Capitalizing, recreating in mini form what God did to create the world. Let me end with one last point. Perhaps now we can understand an insight about Shabbos that we never really understood. How do we know what things are forbidden on Shabbos? We know that there's, right, we're told not to, quote, work on Shabbos. Now, we've spoken before, it doesn't mean work in the laborious sense of that which I'm going to sweat profusely over. That has nothing to do with it. But rather, there are categories of activities that are forbidden. Well, where do we learn that from?
From the building of the tabernacle.
The building of the tabernacle. Now, Michelle, I agree with you, but why is that the source for what I do or don't do on Shabbos? Because that's what they constructed a building? So what?
Well, I would think that if the building of that was not a worthy reason to not follow what was and was not allowed, then whatever else you're doing that's more mundane wouldn't be.
I accept that totally, but you can take it further, Liz. It's not just, oh, it's an important building and we'll use that as a manual of what was and was not allowed.
It's much God's building.
What is this building representing?
God.
Spiritual, the spiritual part coming down.
I'm looking for one word.
A connection.
Creation, that's the word I'm looking for. This construction of the tabernacle is creation all over again. Well, that's exactly what I'm not supposed to do. God worked for 6 days. He created for 6 days. And those specific activities that he refrained from on Shabbos, that's resting. That's exactly what I have to do too. But I wasn't there at creation. I think, Ardeen, I think you're the oldest one here, right? Even you weren't there at the time of creation, right?
I was working.
Right. You were probably fundraising, right? That's, you know, you probably turned to God and said, hey, over here. Okay. Yeah. But the point being is that it's not just a construction of a building that's important, Liz. This building is the microcosm of the original creation. Oh, so God says, I worked for 6 days and were creative and did my processes and I rested on the seventh. I want you to do exactly the same thing. So you raise your hand and you say, but God, I don't know what you did to create it. We were the last creation of the whole week. Oh, God says, don't worry. Look to the other place. The one other place, which is a recreation of creation, is the construction of the tabernacle. Therefore, the processes needed for its construction are the exact processes we don't do on Shabbos. It makes so much more sense now. It's not just a random look to a building or look to construction. It is specifically this building, which is recreating the original Garden of Eden creation that we turn to. Does that make sense? That's it.
So was the Garden of Eden.
What, Randy?
Was the Garden of Eden considered the first temple?
Yeah, I would call it that, yes. That is the original point of environment of connection between God and his universe. That's the environment where, I'll read you, I mean, I took this from Rabbi Hirsch. I love it. His terminology is so good. The Garden of Eden narrative is a postulate concerning the environment in which man can enter into communion with the divine. I did you a favor. I translated it into normal English. Right? But the point being is that the Garden of Eden is exactly the perfect place where everything was balanced between God and his universe. Perfect. That's the temple. That's exactly right, Randy.
And we couldn't have gotten that without the Torah. Because the Torah is a tree of life, Allah.
Only afterwards. Here's a question. Nobody ever discusses this. Were Adam and Eve allowed to eat from the tree of life before they ate from the tree of knowledge? Was that forbidden also? Were they allowed to eat from that tree of life?
No. Yes, they could.
Absolutely, yes. It's only once they ate from the one that they told him not to eat from, then God said, no, no, no. No shortcut for you, buddy. Right? No soup for you. You're going to have to earn your way now. You're going to have to go. You're going to go through the desert. I'm going to give you a Torah, and you're going to schwitz a little bit. No quick bite from that tree. But before they sinned, absolutely. Absolutely could eat it. Okay. I've held you hostage long enough. Any questions? There should be a lot of them.
Can you just spell the name? Because I'm having a hard time understanding how to spell the name.
T-Z-V-I.
No, Bezalel. I'm sorry. I know. I got you.
Bezalel.
Yes. How do you spell it?
B-E-T-Z. I told you there was T-Z in there somewhere. A-L-E-L.
All right,
Betzalel.
Betzalel. I got it. I just couldn't get it.
Hebrew, it's Betzadilamid Aleph Lamed.
What's the numeric value of his name just off the top? I wonder what that would add up to be.
I'll tell you in a second. He has a piece on that. That part I actually underlined. Betzalel. One second. No, he breaks it down differently. It would be 292, 122. 153. I don't know what that equals, but
must equal.
It's got something here. He ties it into some other things. He takes all the names, Betzalel and Chur and Uriah, and he adds it all together to say. But to me, the premise is such a fascinating idea of exploring his name to appreciate the greatness that he was gifted with. It is such a great premise. But I hope at least, even if you didn't follow all the details and how it all, walk away with one principle. This you have to walk away with. That the construction of the tabernacle was, its function was to recreate the environment of where man and God have a communion, an ability to communicate in the perfect way. It was the original Garden of Eden, lost, but now recreated. That's why it's still a central figure. We daven every day, three times a day, that we should rebuild the temple. Who cares? Just bring Mashiach. We have a building. We don't have a building. You know, there's doctors without borders. We'll have Jews without walls. Never going to happen. It's not going to happen. It's just, but the answer is because this is the recreation of that perfect environment. That's all you need to know.
So, Rabbi, on Shabbos, we're also trying to recreate the tabernacle with the challahs and the meal and
correct. The tabernacle, once it was constructed, the activities within it are very much in line with creating that communication and that environment. It's only the construction of the building that we look to. That's a good point. I want to differentiate. The activities, like you point out with the challah, well, that's reminiscent of the showbread that was in the tabernacle, that was on the shulchan, right? That's true. But it's only the activities to construct the building that we look to and say, those are the ones that we don't do. Just to Liz's point, last thing, and that is, how do we know that in fact those are forbidden on Shabbos? How do I know that? The answer is because the construction of the tabernacle, as critically important as it was halted for Shabbos. Yeah. It was not done on Shabbos. You ask yourself, why? If this is the perfect environment that I want to create, it's the Garden of Eden 2.0, then it should override everything. No, the answer is you can't override the original, what Shabbos is all about. You've lost the whole purpose then. That's why Shabbos overrides the construction of the tabernacle. And that's why those activities we don't do on Shabbat. Okay. Anything else? Great. Go take a deep breath, debrief, take a long bath or something. You'll let it sink in. It's in there somewhere. All right. Have a good rest of the week.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.